As I said earlier, our speaker today is Sharon Lukert. Sharon authored Until My Memory Fails Me after being diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. She is a retired Buddhist chaplain and caregiver who served patients and families in multiple settings and draws on her Buddhist perspective based on the teachings by Pema Chodron to bring stories, information, and practices for maintaining a positive quality of life as cognition changes. We welcome Sharon.
Good morning. I want to thank you all for being here this morning, and particularly thank Lynn and the community at UU for inviting me. I'm always happy to talk about this book. Before I get started, I just want to let you know the air quality is a little poor today, and I have asthma, so I might cough a little bit here and there, but I'm not contagious, so no worries. So as she said, I've worked with people with dementia throughout my professional career, and I was then diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment back in 2021. And that started me on a journey of learning more about cognitive decline and how I could, for myself and for others, look at having a better quality of life. We all think that dementia is the end of life, the end of a good life. And it's January from dementia. So I've been around it for a long time, and I know it struggles, but I also know there's lots of moments of joy, and they get overlooked. So I did write this book. It's called Until My Memory Fails Me. In it, I include the people that I worked with who had dementia that I learned so much from. I call them my dementia ancestors, and so there's many of their stories in here and many of the lessons that I learned from them. I write about what it's like to be diagnosed and go through testing, etc., but I also talk about the stigma and bias that's in this in our society against cognitive decline. We really value intellect and youth, and there's a lot of history for generations that goes into that stigma and bias, and it can take a lot to break through that. Personally, I had to do that journey for myself, and also socially. I'm not going to get into that very much today, but I just wanted to let you know that that is included. There's also a section in here about grieving and a section about planning for the future, not only planning on the practical level, which I'm hoping most of you have heard about already, but also on an emotional and spiritual level. I worked as a chaplain for many years, and I know that that's often over emotions and our spiritual well-being are a very important part of our sense of quality of life. I am a Buddhist, and I've had a meditation practice for more than 40 years now. But what I have found most helpful for myself since I've been diagnosed, meditate, a time washing the dishes, whatever. And I'll be introducing you to one of those later in my talk. So I really consider the emotional and spiritual resilience the heart of my book. One of the reasons I do is because I've come to realize that when someone is losing their cognitive abilities, their emotions are still very much intact. They don't go away. So I'm going to read you a little bit from the book right now about that. Excuse me. Emotional memory and the ability to both feel and express emotions last well into the latter stages of dementia. Given this, I wondered if becoming more familiar with and knowing how to work with emotions in the early stages, of cognitive decline might benefit an overall sense of well-being and autonomy into the latter stages, when other forms of memory and communication might not be accessible. I have witnessed firsthand people with moderate and severe dementia continue to relate to the world through their emotions, even when they can no longer voice their thoughts, opinions, and feelings. One dementia ancestor that I'll call Marie lived in a skilled nursing facility and was completely dependent on caregivers to dress and feed her. She often had a smile, although she was unable to speak. I worked as a certified nurse's aide at the time and would rotate with others caring for Marie. She had her favorite CNAs, and when one of them would feed her lunch, she would smile, make eye contact, would try to feed her. She would close her eyes and purse her lips, refusing to take a bite, and she could not be persuaded to eat. This became so obvious that we would switch assignments at mealtimes in order to accommodate her preferences toward some CNAs over others. This is just one example of how emotions continue to impact us, even when we lose our ability to communicate verbally. So how do we work with emotions? It's not something we're taught in school. At least I wasn't. Hopefully the kids are these days, but I doubt it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how emotions work and how we can work with them. Emotions are fluid, not solid and fixed. They are expressions of our true self and can hold the potential to connect us deeply with ourselves, which includes the full kaleidoscope of emotions. Through allowing a feeling to soften, there is the opportunity to recognize that each one of us has the ability to connect with this energy directly. Love, joy, compassion, and equanimity, which are called the qualities of an open heart in Buddhism, are the underlying container for this emotion. Learning how to allow the fluidity of feelings to move through us and shift builds emotional resilience and strengthens our ability to weather any emotional storm with a little more ease. There's a practice called the pause practice, which is one way to work with strong emotions, allowing a bit of space and time to become familiar with what we are experiencing in the moment, whether that is the openness and relaxation of feeling happy, like a warm summer breeze, or the cold, blustering winds of confusion and worry. Suggestions from a scientific perspective and the Buddhist view are essentially identical. When a strong feeling arises, especially one that seems to occur for you often, first acknowledge it as a guest at your door and let it be. In other words, allow yourself to experience the feeling without adding any story to it or pushing it away. Can you stay with the raw energy of that emotion? Next, do something different. That last piece is key. So I'm going to ask you, have anyone here heard of neuroplasticity? Great, good. So neuroplasticity means that we can change the way we think. And the way I like to describe it is if you think about hiking, I'll give that as an example. If you're hiking a trail that's never been walked on before, it can be really hard, and you have to push the weeds away, and you worry about the ticks, and you know where exactly are you going, and all of that. It's kind of cumbersome. But if a trail's been walked on over and over again, it becomes easier and easier. It's like that in our brain. We have neural pathways that we've developed over and over and over again. It's not only the way that we think, but it's also that the way we react to our feelings, our emotions. So if you think, usually the easiest one is think of a time when you've been a little mad at somebody. And how do you respond to anger? We usually have a pretty routine way to respond to anger. Some people yell, some people give the person the silent treatment. That's usually what I do. Some people stomp out of the room, you know. But what that is a routine that your brain is used to whenever you get angry. So we can change it. We actually have the ability to choose, and it takes time to develop, just like the weeds. You know, it's going to take a little while to change that behavior. See, where am I? Okay, there I am. I'm going to tell you one story of a time that I used the pause practice early on when I was diagnosed. One of my early symptoms, and it's still a symptom now, is I've become very clumsy. It's not a symptom people think of when they think of cognitive decline, but actually it's pretty common. And so there was one morning when I was in the kitchen and I had just made myself some tea, and I had this lovely little glass teapot that I just adored this teapot. And somehow I swiped my arm across the countertop and knocked it onto the floor, and it shattered into wet, hot tea and glass all over the place. Well, one of the things, I was giving myself a really hard time. How could I be so stupid? You know, this meant so much to me, and now I have to go buy another one. And, you know, I mean, la, la, la. It just automatically came up. And as I reached for the towel to start cleaning up the mess, I realized what I was doing, and I just stopped, and I took a couple of breaths. And I allowed myself to just feel what I was feeling underneath all that self-denigration, which was sadness, not only for losing the teapot, but for what it represented. I was losing a piece of myself. So then I was able to pick up the towel and clean up the mess, and I was still sad, but I wasn't giving myself a hard time anymore. I was treating myself with a little bit of kindness. So that's what I mean by having the choice. Sure, we're going to go down that road a little bit. It's such a routine that, of course, we're going to have that as a first response. But we can change that. We can take a breath. We can look at ourselves and really feel what we're feeling. And that builds that resilience that we can then, when stronger feelings come up, we know how to work with them. So at this point, I'd like to lead you through. It's very brief, this pause practice I've been talking about. And as I said, it's something you can do anywhere, anytime. I have to say, I do this a lot in the grocery store. It can be a place where, you know, some people can, you know, rarely become annoying, you know, like when you're trying to get to the carrots and somebody just won't move, or, you know, they cut in front of you in line. So those are moments when I'll use the pause practice. It's very easy. So I'll guide you through it. It's kind of like counting to 10. So if you can just get in a comfortable position, and this can be done eyes open or closed, however you're most comfortable. And it's just working with the breath. So you're going to be taking three deep breaths in, and you can do this at your own pace. I'll just be talking you through for the first time, and then I'll be quiet for a few moments and just allow you to do it on your own. So first, bring up an emotion, really a small one, like stubbing your toe or something, not a big one. It's a place to start. It might even be something that happened this morning. And on your first deep breath in, just notice what's happening in your body. And then as you breathe out, let that go. On your next breath in, just notice what's happening with your thoughts. And as you breathe out, just let that go. On the third breath, breathe in and notice what's going on emotionally. You don't need to change it, just notice. And then let that go. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes if they're closed and come back to the room. We'll have a time for question and answer later if anything came up you want to ask about that practice. So I also want to speak briefly about spiritual resilience, which is the other piece that I mentioned. I found that working with people at the end of their life, whether it's from dementia or anything else, spirituality becomes incredibly important. And so finding ways that you can carry what's important to you into your later life, even through dementia, can be incredibly supportive for quality of life. I'll use my mom as a quick example because she was someone who, she was raised Episcopalian, and as I became a Buddhist, she became familiar with Buddhism, and she enjoyed reading books by my teacher, Pema Chodron. I had a picture of Pema, and I gave it to her. Well, right up until the day before she died, she recognized who Pema was, and she would point to that picture, and she would say, "She's with me." And it gave her a sense of safety and connection that I don't know if anything else would have. And it can be anything. It can be a prayer, it can be a song, it can be a picture of your favorite fishing hole, you know. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's something that helps connect you. And so recognizing that now, and again, building those neural pathways of looking at that picture or saying this phrase, that if you do that continually, and also maybe write it down so others know to help you with that later on if you're not able to help yourself. The other thing that really brought her joy was being able to give you, I'm just looking to plant seeds here for things you can think about for your own future or for your family and your loved ones or your friends. Dealing with dementia and cognitive issues is very challenging, and even more so in our society right now. It's starting to change, but it's a long, slow slog making that kind of change in healthcare. So the more we can do to increase our own quality of life and the quality of life for those that we love, because there are those moments of joy. And even if it's just a short moment, it's important. It's important to the family, and it's important to the person who feels it. So I just want you to keep that in mind. And I'm going to close with a phrase I like to use as a blessing, and then I'll open it up for questions and answers. Questions. I'll try to answer. We'll see. As you go forward into the unknown future with gentleness, patience, and determination. And after the talk, I'll be at the back. We do have some books, and I also have a newsletter sign-up sheet if you're interested. So any comments or questions?
Thanks for your talk. I find fostering equanimity with thoughts and emotions when you're meditating to be sort of cognitively challenging in some respects, which obviously gets harder as cognition declines. I'm wondering if, in your experience personally or working with other people, if you found that more somatic practices, body-focused awareness works better, particularly for the later stages of cognitive decline?
Yeah, definitely. It does change. My meditation has already changed. I used to do retreats and practice for hours at a time, and 15 minutes is about my comfort level right now, and that's okay. And that's one reason why I focus on the spot meditations. And I do include a body scan in the book as well, because sometimes just being physical is what you need, not sitting quietly. Walks in nature. I can't say, it's hard to express how supportive a walk in nature can be for someone. And if they're confined, I mean, my mom loved looking out the window and watching the trees and the birds, you know. Even if you're confined to a room, you can still have some connection with the outside. So thank you for asking. Yeah. Other comments or questions? You're right that it's different at different times. It's also very different for different people, as we were just mentioning. It's a matter of experimenting, you know. If you don't know already what that is for someone, if someone doesn't have, say, someone doesn't have a meditation practice, and I have to say, most of the people that I worked with as a chaplain were not meditators, and I didn't impose meditation on them. But I would be curious with them of what is it that brings you joy? What is it that helps you feel connected? There was one woman, this was many years ago, back when Enya was new, if those of you who know who Enya is, and she was dying of COPD, which is respiratory. So she was very, she she had a lot of short breaths, and it was very anxiety-provoking. And so I did a guided visualization with her, and what she discovered was that listening to Enya helped calm her down and helped her feel connected. Now, I never would have guessed that, you know, but it's by exploring. And it might be something different the next day, but for her at that time, that's what really helped her at the end of her life. So it's being curious and open and, you know, hopefully knowing the person a little bit. Yeah.
This will be our life.
From my experience, what I'm familiar with is working on ourselves can change the dynamic within a family system. It doesn't happen quickly, though. All you can do is really care for yourself. And these practices can be just as helpful for a caregiver as they can be for the person caring that you're caring for. Learning, just working with your own emotions, recognizing what's there, pausing, working on, you know, seeing the bigger picture as best you can when you're in the middle of what can be very difficult dynamics. It's not easy work. It certainly isn't. But there's a lot of supports, and that's the other thing, getting outside support for yourself, and if other family members are willing, support groups are incredible for caregivers. And you can never start too early. I think that's a good place to end. I want to thank you all.